So we want to strive then to be in this favored position that God speaks of by this water, where we're going to be as the grass and as the willows by the water courses. Then he further, in verse 5, relates what it's going to be like when God is with his people and when he forgives them of their sins. One shall say, I am the Lord's, and another shall call himself by the name of Jacob, and another shall subscribe with his hand unto the Lord and surname himself by the name of Israel. This is what God's people are going to do. And of course, this is not only a time relating to their return to Jerusalem, but this is also a prophecy about the New Testament age right now today. One shall say, I am the Lord's. Now that's a true sign, of course, of somebody who has a desire to be God's people. For a person to say, I am the Lord's. To proclaim, I belong to the Lord. You know, there are some people who really deep down want to live a Christian life, but they're really ashamed to make any kind of a declaration before anybody else that they really are a Christian, that they are God's people. But he says one's going to say that then. And another should call himself by the name of Jacob. Of course, Jacob was a name given to God's people, and it really means call himself by the name that would refer to being a member of God's household. A name that would relate him to God. And another shall subscribe with his hand unto the Lord. Now, to subscribe with his hand means that he takes something and he writes. He writes with his hand. Either about the Lord, or he writes with his hand that he is a part of the Lord's people. Something about writing with his hand that has to do with relating to God. And surname himself by the name of Israel. That is, he's going to wear the name of Israel. One wear, it said, be wearing the name of Jacob. One wear the name of Israel. Well, today we wear the name of the Lord. We wear the name of Christian. We wear the name of being God's people. Whatever name that would identify us with being God's, we wear that name. And we wear it in a way that we're not ashamed of it. Beginning in verse 6 of Isaiah 44, God shows how that he is the true God and how ridiculous it is, how stupid, how foolish it is to follow after idolatry. And this is probably one of the plainest, one of the most easily understood passages that really deals with the folly of idolatry. He says in verse 6, thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first, and I am the last, and beside me there is no other God. Now think of that just for a moment. He's the Lord, the King of Israel. Well, we know that God has always had a kingdom here. Well, not always, but he's had a kingdom ever since Saul was the first king. And he's always had a spiritual kingdom when he's had a group of people that were a nation that was his nation. And the ultimate king of his people is the Lord. He is the king. He is the leader. He's the ruler. He makes the laws for his nation, which happens to be the Christian nation. That's not just the United States of America. It's any Christian in the world is a member of the Christian nation. And his laws supersede all other laws. There are no other laws made by any other power that overrule the laws of God. So that if any nation were to require us to do something that would violate God's will, we would have to say, God comes first. You can put me in prison, you can torture me, you can take my life, you can do whatever, but God's will comes first. I obey his laws first. And then if the laws of the nation do not conflict, we obey the laws of the land. And very, very few laws of the land would ever conflict with God's law, although there might be an occasion like that. For example, in the book of Acts, whenever the civil law commanded the apostles not to preach anymore in the name of Jesus, well, they weren't going to follow that. They weren't going to follow that command. They said, well, who should we obey, God or men? God always comes first. So he's the king. And his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts. That is, God is also the Redeemer. He's the one who has redeemed us from our sins. Then he describes himself by saying, I am the first and I am the last. And besides me, there is no other God. Now just think of that for a moment. God was here before anything else was. He's the first. And He will be here when nothing else is left. He's the last. And besides me, He says, there is no other God. Now, you know, the world has this idea of, regardless of who it is, if it's somebody from China or Japan or the South Sea Islands or the Indians or whoever, well, he worships his God, we worship our God. We have all manner of respect for this man's feeling and his belief and his worship. And they even go and they mimic the idolatrous and the paganistic kinds of worship. But that's not what God says. He says, besides me, there is no other God. There's not any other God. And it's just like if you're married to somebody, a husband or a wife, and you have an understanding between yourselves that besides me, you don't have any other husband, or besides me, you don't have any other wife. I am it. And to violate that trust, to violate that that confidence, that agreement, then is adultery in the marriage state, and in our relation with God, it is spiritual adultery. For us to go off and to follow after any other thing is adultery in the eyes of God. He says there's no other God. Now, it doesn't take anybody who's been to a school of divinity or who has a doctor's degree or anything else to figure out what he's saying here. It's very plain. There's no other God besides me. So your actions, your thoughts, anything that would lead you into something besides what I have given for you is wrong, because there's not any other God but me. Not the sun, not the moon, not some philosophical thing, not Buddha, not the Great Spirit. There is no other God, he says, but me. And who, as I, shall call and shall declare it and shall set an order for me since I appointed the ancient people? And God just asked the question, who is able to do like I do? Who can do as I and call and declare it and set in order for me since I appointed the ancient people? You know, God created man. He put man on this earth. That's the ancient people. He appointed the ancient people. And since that time, God has set in the order of things. He has called the events before they've happened. He's brought these events about. He has said things were going to happen as they did, and they did happen that way. And God asked the question, who's done like I've done? Who's been able to do what I've done here? And the things that are coming and shall come, let them show unto them. Who's been able to tell the things that are coming? The things that are going to come? There's no other God but me, he says. Fear ye not, neither be afraid. Have not I told thee from that time and declared it? Haven't I told you how things are going to be? Haven't I declared it? Haven't I brought it about? Can't you see that I'm the true God? Can't you see the evidence of me? And in light of this, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Fear not, he says, neither be afraid. Ye are even my witnesses. Is there a God besides me? Yea, there is no God. I know not any, he says. There's not any other God besides me. You can be witnesses to that fact. You can testify to that fact. You've never seen one. You've never known one. There's no evidence of any other God. They that make a graven image are all of them vanity, and their delectable things shall not profit, and they are their own witnesses. They see not, nor know, that they may be ashamed. Now he's talking about idolatry here. They that make a graven image are all of them vanity. Now the word vanity means worthless. It's in vain, it is worthless, it is useless, it is of no benefit. Now think of that. It is of no benefit. Consequently, they who make these graven images, a graven image is one that has been carved out. They who make these graven images, they are vanity. They are worthless. They are useless. In the sight of God, they're not worth anything. They are of no benefit to God whatsoever. He's put them here for a purpose, and they are not fulfilling that purpose. And their delectable things shall not profit. Now, this word delectable here means those delicate things that they've made, their idols, their images, he says, shall not profit. And they are their own witnesses. These idols are the best witness you could ever have as to how unprofitable they are. For he says, they see not, nor know. They don't see anything. They don't know anything. They're dumb. That's the best witness you could have to show that it is a worthless, useless piece of junk, that they may be ashamed. Now we may think, well, this is a lot of talking here about idolatry, which is really not very much profit to us. We're not plagued with idolatry today, are we? And the answer is yes, we are. There are idols on every hand today. A large area of so-called Christians use idols. They bow down to them. They serve them. They worship them. They hold them in great veneration. The putting up of any kind of an image of the cross, an image of Christ hanging from the cross, an image of an angel, of the Virgin Mary, of one of the apostles, any of these images that are held in holy adoration are really idols. And they're used in that way. I have a copy here of the November 74 issue of the National Geographic. I just happened to pick it up a while ago. And I want to show you a couple of things in here that are idols that are in current use today as idols. And it's sanctioned by the Catholic Church down in Guatemala. Here's a picture of an idol that's an Indian idol that is used in a part of their worship in Catholicism. And over here on another page is a picture of a Catholic church now, and studded on the sides of this building, I'll pass it around where you can see it, on the sides of this building are the idols that they have placed here as a part of their worship. And no doubt inside the building they have the same thing. Every Catholic church that I've been inside of has these idols that are in the walls of the building that the people hold in some kind of a holy veneration. They are idols, nothing more, nothing less than idols. And so it's so easy today for idolatry to be shrugged off as nothing. Oh, it's just nothing. But they put that in the place of God, and they try to mingle their worship to God with these things. And I would just notice what he says about them. In verse 10, who hath formed a god, or molten a graven image that is profitable for nothing? Isaiah, as though he looks around and he asks, who's done this anyway? Who's guilty of this? Just who would be so foolish as to do something like this? Behold, all his fellows shall be ashamed, and the workmen, they are of men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up. Yea, they shall fear, and they shall be ashamed together. The men who make these things, he said, are just, they're men. They're just men like anybody else. There's nothing holy or inspired about them in their work. They're just men. They're going to all, just bring them all together here and look at them, observe them, put them on trial, see just where these idols come from. Now in verse 12 it begins to show how the idol is made. The smith with the tongs both worketh in the coals, and fashioneth with hammers, and worketh it with the strength of his arms. Yea, he is hungry, and his strength faileth. He drinketh no water, and is faint. Now this word tongs here means axe. And he shows how that from the very beginning, how that they make the axe then that is going to make the idol. The axe that is made, he says he works in the coals and fashioned it with hammers. That is, an axe is something that was beaten out. It wasn't molded, but it was heated in the coals, made hot, and then it was beat out into the shape that it should be. That's the way the axe was made. And I had the privilege summer before last, when we were in Canada, of seeing a blacksmith make a tool in this very same way. Get it real hot and beat it out so that it had a point on it. it says he fashioned it with hammers and worketh it with the strength of his arms. And everybody knows that, that those who are in the blacksmith trade build up tremendous strength in their arms because of this constant beating that they do with the hammers as they mold this metal into the proper shape. Yea, he is hungry and his strength faileth. He drinketh no water and is faint. Now that's a little difficult to understand there, but it could mean one of two things to me. It could mean that here's a man that if he doesn't eat, he's going to lose his strength. If he doesn't drink water, he's going to faint. He's just a mortal man like anybody else. But it could also be a reference to the practice of these idol makers who became so engrossed in their work. And there is record today of even in the modern times of some of the people who make idols. They get so engrossed in their work until they vow they'll neither eat nor drink until they get this thing finished. And that may be what he's referring to there. And some of them have been known to go for as long as 3 days with no food and no water while they were finishing the making of one of these gods. So we get the axe then made. The axe is the thing that's going to hew this thing out. Then in verse 13, he talks about the carpenter. The carpenter stretcheth out his rule. He makes it out. He marketh it out with a line. He fitteth it with planes. And he marketh it out with the compass. And maketh it after the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. But this carpenter now, he stretcheth out his rule. What he has here is a block of wood, and he takes a rule and he stretches it out to measure it. And then he says that he marketh it with a line, and the word there, line, means chalk. He marketh it out with a line, and he fitteth it with planes, and the word planes means chisels, and he marketh it out with a compass. A compass is a circular device so that he can make it symmetrical just as he wants to make it in the image of a being. And he maketh it after the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man. Now these idols almost invariably end up being in some kind of a figure or form like a man. He makes it in the figure of a man, he says. According to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. Now, even the great idols of the Greeks, Apollo and Venus and Jupiter, these were all idols in the form of human beings. They made them in the form of human beings. Now, I wouldn't expect God to be in the exact form of a human being. And he's not, of course. God isn't limited to a form like that. But idols are made like human beings. And he says that it may remain in the house. And to remain in the house here may mean one of two different things. It could have a reference to the fact that this idol was good for nothing and had to be kept in a house. But it probably has a reference to the fact that all of the temples of the false gods are decorated with these idols. There's idols on every side. All the walls are decorated with these idols. They are a part of the furniture of the temples. And of course, as we look at these great cathedrals that are so-called, supposed to be Christian cathedrals, they're not Christian and they never were, but they claim to be, they too are decorated with these idols. The great carvings, the great artwork, Michelangelo and so on, they are really figures that the people just worship. And this is the very thing that God is talking about here. Taking a block of wood and going to all of the careful, skillful, meticulous effort to carve it out in the shape of a man. Verse 14, he further describes this. He heweth him down cedars and taketh a cypress, and the oak, which he strengtheneth for himself among the trees of the forest, he planteth an ash, and the rain doth nourish it. Now he takes the very best of the woods, and he names some of these woods here, the cedar, and the cypress, and the oak. And he says that he takes these which he strengtheneth for himself among the trees of the forest. And it's a little difficult to know what that means, which he strengtheneth for himself, but it may very well mean that he is in the business of raising these trees. He plants them, he nourishes them, he cares for them, and sees that he gets a good, strong tree. And just as through the ages, The raising and producing of trees has been an art for whatever man has needed trees for. There are certain trees that have been planted and nourished just for the special use in the building of cabinets and of fine furniture. Others for paper, others for the building of houses and so on. But here he strengthened it for himself among the trees of the forest. He planteth an ash, and the rain doth nourish it. So he plants these trees. He takes care of them for the special purpose of making idols. And it's a little bit ironic here when he says he plants the trees, and the rain doth nourish it. Here we have several things that are at work to try to get this this tree growing. A man has to plant it, and the rain has to nourish it. So the idol's not really able to take care of himself at all. And after they get the wood, now notice what happens in verse 15. Then shall it be for a man to burn. For he will take thereof and warm himself. Yea, he kindleth it and baketh bread. Yea, he maketh a god and worshipeth it. He maketh a graven image and falleth down thereto. Now notice the absurdity here. He takes this wood and he burns it. He uses it to warm himself by. He also uses it to cook his bread on. But he also takes the same piece of wood and he makes a god out of it and he falls down and worships it. So God's showing the futility here, the stupidity of this action. He burneth part of it in the fire, with part of it thereof he eateth flesh, he roasteth roast and is satisfied. Yea, he warmeth himself and saith, ah, I am warm, I have seen the fire. And the residue thereof he maketh a god, even his graven image. He falleth down unto it, and worshipeth it, and prayeth unto it, and saith, deliver me, for thou art my God. Now, can you imagine the absurdity of this? Take the same piece of wood, and you make a fire, and you heat yourself by it. You warm yourself by it. You cook your meal on it, and you eat the meal. You say, ah, it's a good meal. Then you take whatever's left there, and you carve it into a god, and you fall down to it, you worship it, you serve it, you pray to it, and you say, deliver me, God. Now, anybody that's got any kind of sense about them can see that that is a stupid act. That's an act of no benefit whatsoever, so far as salvation, so far as God, so far as religion goes. But you know, it's no different to take a piece of charred wood and carve it into a god and worship it and say, deliver me, God, for thou art my God, than it is to have some kind of an imaginary god up here in our mind that doesn't really exist, a god that we just kind of created out of our own think-sos, out of our own desires, and then when we get into trouble to pray to that god. So pray. But that's what we do today, and that's what was happening way back here when God was condemning idolatry. They have not known nor understood, for he has shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. These people just don't know what they're doing, he says. They're not able to see the true, utter folly of their actions. God has shut their eyes, and this word shut their eyes is taken from a phrase that means to actually take some plaster and seal over the eyes so that you cannot see. He shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. You know, we have a truth given in the New Testament that fits this very well. In 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, verse 10, God teaches there that if a person does not love the truth, that he would send them a strong delusion that they should believe a lie so that they might be damned. Now, delusion is a false belief. And a strong delusion is a strong false belief. And all you have to do to get a strong false belief is just simply not love the truth. Not love the truth. Now, when you love the truth, it means you're not going to hurt it in any kind of way. You're not going to harm the truth. You're not going to twist it. You're not going to wrest it, as we studied Sunday. You're not going to add anything to it. You're not going to take anything from it. You're just going to let it teach what it teaches and leave it unharmed. That's what it means to love the truth. Those who want to change it for their own purposes, to suit their own means, their own doctrine, prove that they don't love it, And consequently, they'll have a strong false belief. And you can't shake them out of it. They'll be unshakable because it's strong. And so it is about those who are so foolish as to want to worship these gods, these idols. He says that they have not known or understood, for he has shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their heart that they cannot understand. And none considereth in his heart, neither is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I have burned part of it in the fire, yea, also I have baked part of it upon the coals thereof, I have roasted flesh and eaten it, and shall I make the residue thereof an abomination? Shall I fall down to the stock of a tree? He said they don't even have enough thought to even think about that. After they've used this same piece of wood to burn it for fire, to burn it to cook with, they use what's left of it. He said, shall I then make an abomination? That's what an idol really is in the sight of God. It's an abomination. Shall I fall down to the stock of a tree? To the what's left of a tree here, what comes from a tree? Is that what I'm going to fall down to? And so it is with us today. We might as well be falling down and worshiping a stump someplace, going out here and praying to a telephone pole, as to try to serve God with our vain traditions, the tradition that we receive from men. You know, we've talked about these vain things before. The absurdity of thinking that there's anything holy or religious or even significant about having an Easter bunny associated with laying an Easter egg and having to do with the resurrection of Christ. You know, there's just no religious connection there, but that's what the doctors of divinity put off on their people. And they don't stop and consider, even try to understand, is that what I am doing to try to worship God? Is that what I'm going through with? Just where is the rationale? Verse 20, he feedeth on ashes. A deceived heart hath turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? Now he feedeth on ashes. This word to feed here means to graze, or it means to take on nourishment. And so what really is happening, this man who is seeking after some kind of spiritual solace, who is wanting spiritual comfort and security, who is needing the spiritual food of God, instead of getting that, he's feeding on ashes, which is really what that tree is. It's just ashes. It's either ashes that's left over from what he didn't use when he burned it in the fire, or it's what's fixing to be burned when it finally does meet fire. And he's feeding on ashes. And it's just like man today who is in a great state of spiritual dearth. One of the prophets says that there's a famine in the land. And that famine in the land, of course, is a spiritual famine. This nation we're living in right today has a great spiritual famine. The people are starving to death spiritually. They might be well fed physically. They might have the best developed bodies there ever were, but they are spiritually starved. And when they go to eat, when they go to get something to eat spiritually, they feed on ashes. Eating a bunch of weeds. Something that's not going to do them any good at all. This is what Isaiah's talking about here. They're eating ashes. A deceived heart has turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul. The man's not able to take himself out of the problem that he's in. He's not able to see what kind of difficulty he's in, because he says that a deceived heart has turned him aside. He's had his mind fooled or deceived or betrayed. He's following after something that's a lie. It is not even a true God at all. It's not true religion at all. A deceived heart has turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul. He has no power, no ability to extricate himself from that terrible state of depravity that he's in. He cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? He's not even able to say that this thing that he's holding in his right hand, that he's worshiping, that he's calling his God, that he's depending upon for spiritual food, he's not able to say, isn't that a lie? And truly, we ought to be able to say that. We ought to be able to look around about us and to see those things that we're doing and those things that we are committed to and look at it objectively and to say, well, is that a lie? Is that really the truth or not? Do we have the book, chapter, and the verse verifying that? Has God taught me that this is what is to be done? Or am I just following it because my forefathers?